The session tonight is on Namibia. I realized the first time I did a session on Namibia at Holden Village was in 1974. And in a sense, a lot has changed since then, and in another sense, not much has changed at all, which is very, very sad. I've passed out a yellow sheet which has a map of Africa on one side, or at least the southern part of Africa. You will see that Namibia, which used to be called Southwest Africa, is in the southwest corner of Africa. It borders on South Africa, Botswana, a little bit. The Caprivi Strip goes out and hits Zimbabwe, which used to be called Rhodesia, Zambia, and Angola to the north, to give you an idea of where this country is located. I think I would like to start by giving a little history of South Africa, because South Africa is mainly responsible for the tremendous amount of oppression and bloodshed that is going on in Namibia at this time. In 1494, Vasco da Gama was sailing around the Cape of Good Hope, discovered Africa, or southern Africa in a sense. He was hired to try to find a new way from Europe to India, very much like Christopher Columbus, and almost at the same time that Columbus discovered America, Vasco da Gama is discovering the continent of southern Africa. In the late part of the 16th century, the English tried to establish a colony down there by sending prisoners, and they released all these prisoners and said, now if you just go and start a colony and start living down there and kind of hold it for the British Empire, we'll be eternally grateful, or whatever the Queen or the King said at that time. Some prisoners went down. It didn't work too well, but they did establish a little bit of a colony in the latter part of the 16th century. In the meantime, there were some Dutch that were also sailing around the Cape of Good Hope at the bottom of the continent, and they were shipwrecked, and they saw this beautiful, marvelous country, and wrote back and said, I really think we ought to establish a colony here. So the Dutch East India Company, which is probably a name familiar to you, decided to send a doctor, Jan van Riebeck, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his name right, Jan van Riebeck, I would say, to try to establish a colony for the Dutch. So here you have the English and the Dutch, which was a little bit of a problem to begin with. As the Dutch settled in the southern part of southern Africa, they then started moving up further into the continent. They met a lot of blacks, as you can imagine, who inhabited the territory. They called them Hottentots. They asked them to move out of the way. There were a lot of skirmishes and wars between the blacks and the Dutch. There was also a lot of intermarrying. And this mixed race, which developed from the miscegenation that took place there, these people are now called coloreds. The coloreds are a class that is a class unto itself in southern Africa and also in Namibia. You will discover as we go through the session tonight that there are three groups of people. The whites. Maren, I just can't yell over you. Bye-bye. The whites, the coloreds, and the blacks. The coloreds are not to be confused with the black people in South Africa. They are a result of white and black intermarriages. By 1795, the Dutch had 15,000 people living in South Africa. They were called Afrikaners. So I'm sure you've heard that term, but just get all your terms straight for the different kinds of people that are there. There were three different kinds of Afrikaners. There were the traders and the people that ran hotels or the innkeepers. These all lived in the city, in Cape Town. Then there were the Boern, or they were called Boers, B-O-E-R-S. They were the corn and wine farmers. And then the Trekboeren were the poor nomadic farmers that kind of wandered around. So there was very much a class distinction among the Dutch settlers at that time. Then comes Britain again. In 1875, the British capture the Cape of Good Hope. And by 1775. By 1820, there were 5,000 British settlers now living in the Cape of Good Hope, in that area. And by the 1800s, the British started to move deeper into Africa, just as the Dutch had done. They were having very repressive laws, and the Dutch were very upset, so they started to move even further into the African continent, and this is known as the Great Trek. If you've heard of that, it's very similar to our Western expansion in America, and they did the very same thing that we did to the Native Americans. They killed off the blacks as they came, they took their land, they moved them onto specific areas to live. Things got so bad that by the year 1899 to 1902, we have what is known as the Boer Wars, the war between the British and the Dutch. And the peace that followed this very short but very bloody war formed the Union of South Africa. That's how the Union of South Africa came about, and now you have British and Dutch controlling this territory, with the blacks and the coloreds having absolutely no representation and very little rights. No representation in government and very little rights. All right, I just want to give you a little bit of the history of South Africa, so maybe it will help us understand a little bit more what's going on in Namibia at this time. If you see the blue sheet that I handed out, it has some dates that I thought were important. There are many other things regarding the church and labor disputes and labor strikes that I did not include, but briefly, Namibia was settled basically by Germans. Just as South Africa was settled basically by Dutch and English, the Germans were the ones that settled further up above the Union of South Africa in the territory that was known as Southwest Africa. And by 1884, the German flag flew over this little territory. It's not such a little territory. It's twice the size of California, 1,000 miles of coastland, and about the size of Montana area-wise. After the defeat of Germany in World War I, this country, this territory, was taken away from the Germans, and the League of Nations gave it to South Africa to use or to manage, to govern as a sacred trust. They gave 5 territories to South Africa to govern, and they were to administer it in the best sense that they could for the benefit of all the inhabitants of that territory. Well, by 1945, the League of Nations became the United Nations, and they discovered that South Africa was not caring for Southwest Africa in the best interests of its inhabitants. They were exploiting it. They were making literal slaves of the people. South Africa was told, "Would you please give up your mandate now? We're going to make it a special trusteeship, put it in under our trusteeship system, and it will be governed by a council under the United Nations." Well, South Africa refused. Not only did they refuse, they decided to set up the apartheid system. At a speech in the United Nations several years ago, a man from Africa said, "The apartheid system is universally recognized as constituting the most brutal and violent form of human exploitation and suffering unsurpassed in the contemporary world." Apartheid is the legal separation of blacks and whites, and it is one of the most dehumanizing violent systems that can exist, as we'll see. By 1949, South Africa refuses any longer to even submit reports to the United Nations about what they're doing. In 1961, the case is brought before the International Court of Justice. The judges that sit on this court declared after five years of debate that the status of South Africa, of Southwest Africa, was going to remain unchanged because it had to be thrown out of court on a legal technicality. In 1966, 5 years to debate this subject, and then it gets thrown out. In 1966, the UN Security Council and General Assembly vote to terminate South African mandate and transfer control and governing of the country of Southwest Africa to a special council. But as so often happens in the United Nations, there was no teeth put in this resolution. The United Nations is only as strong as the countries that make up the United Nations, and if they decide they don't want to do something, there is nothing really the United Nations can do. No country that voted for this put any teeth into it as far as economic sanctions or any other kind of sanctions against South Africa. So in a sense, South Africa continues to thumb its nose at the United Nations, continues to let the apartheid system and their exploitation of Southwest Africa exist. In 1968, the people that lived in Southwest Africa decided to change their name. They said, we are tired of the oppression. We need a shield against the white oppressor. We are going to change our name to Namibia. This comes from the Namib Desert, which if you look at your map on the other side, which is a picture of Namibia, it's not too good of a picture, but the very dark lines here, Botswana is on the right, Namibia is on the left. And the Bantustans, or the reservations up at the north, and Damaraland are where the Namib Desert is. It goes all the way down the coast with a very a wide stretch on the coastland that is very fertile, wonderful land as I understand it. But inland is this terrific desert that is more or less a shield between the ocean and the central part of the country. So the Namibians have called themselves Namibia after that Namib Desert. Finally, in 1971, 13 years ago, the International Court of Justice handed down the opinion that South Africa is illegally in Namibia and they should get out immediately. But again, South Africa says, no, we're not going. We like it here. We like what we're doing. So just leave us alone, in essence. Okay, now I'm going to go a little bit into the apartheid system, and we'll look at the rest of those dates in a little bit. First of all, some statistics. I said it's 900 to 1,000 miles, the coastland. There are 1.5 million people living in Namibia. That's not heavily populated. 80% of the people are black. 10% are colored or Asian. About 2% are Asian, actually, 8% colored, and 10% white. The 10% of the population owns 87% of the land. All of the oil is controlled by the white population, the 10%. All of the diamond mines,
are they British
and Dutch, the Afrikaners and the British. A lot of British companies own different things, as do American companies also. But all of the mineral mines, especially the copper mines, the new Rossing uranium mine, all the fishing industry is controlled by the white population. Economists say that if the wealth of Namibia were distributed evenly, every person in Namibia would find themselves to be the richest person in Africa. The land is that wealthy because the minerals, the oil, the diamonds are very, very wonderful things to invest in and bring a lot of money into the country, but most of that money goes back to South Africa. In keeping with the apartheid system, these are some of the things that happen. All of the blacks have been herded into 9 Bantustans. A Bantu is a name for a black. You will see them outlined here on the map. At the very top, I want you to see right south of Angola is Ovambo, Ovamboland. That is where 350,000 inhabitants live. Way over half of the people in Namibia itself are Lutheran, but most of our Lutheran brothers and sisters live in Ovambo land. Herero land over here on the right side of the country, can you see it? That's 4/5 desert. There is literally, virtually, like one well. I mean, there is hardly any water. None of these Bantustans have any fertile land. Ovambo land probably has more than any. Rehoboth, down in the middle, is a township or a Bantustan that is right below the capital, Windhoek. And that's because all of the servants and the people that work for the whites are not allowed to be in white territory, so they have to have their own reservation. But you can count 9 different Bantustans where the blacks have been put. There is a passbook system. If you're not in a Bantustan or a reservation, you are considered to be in the police state. The police state is simply a name given to the white territory where blacks and coloreds are not allowed to go without a passbook. The passbook is 90 pages thick. Please remember that Africans do not carry purses or have pockets like men do to even carry a wallet in. Here's this 90-page passbook that has everything from your dental record to your great-grandparents, and I don't know, I've not seen a passbook, I've just seen pictures of them, but they're very clumsy to carry around, and if you are caught without a passbook or without permission to be in the police state, you are subject to arrest. There is what is called under the apartheid system the labor contract system. Because you cannot eke out a living in your Bantustan, the men must go out of the Bantustan in order to work. They do this by applying to a labor contract system where they are put into one classification. You are either A, B, or C. The C are the younger boys, the maimed, the blind, the men that are very old and not very strong. They become farmers, and what they do basically is to work for the white landowners, many of whom own caracol sheep. If you know about these sheep, they are slaughtered in Namibia for Persian wool. They are exported. 5.5 million sheep are slaughtered each year, and their skins are sent outside of the country, and when we buy Persian lamb coats, that is the caracol sheep. One of the books that I was reading said that this might be a source of food for the people, but it isn't. They're not allowed to eat the lamb. The lamb is fed to cattle. An average wage for a black worker on one of these farms is $5 a month. Uranium mining. The new Rossing mine owned by a British company has opened. I'm not sure whether it's near Walvis Bay, which is over here on the coast of Namibia, which is owned by the British, or whether it's near Windhoek, the capital, but it's near one of those larger cities. Namibia is now mining a sixth of all the uranium in the free world. The problem is that the black workers have no protection from the radioactive dust. There is no medical checkup. There is no medical provision made. The radioactive tailings simply sit like our tailings out here at Holden. And the Bantustan, or not the Bantustan, but the township near this uranium mine where the blacks are forced to live, literally is up against the radioactive tailings. So there's great concern from human rights groups about the black workers in the uranium mine, the Rossing mine. The Tsumi copper mine is south of Ovamboland, right in the central part of Namibia. It is the largest copper mine in Namibia. A contract to work there takes A and B workers, very strong men. They must leave their families for 6 to 12 months. You're not allowed to go back and be with your family. You are put in barracks with 600 other men. You are fed food from a pail with a shovel. It's the most dehumanizing working conditions that you can imagine. If you think that movie Oliver was bad when we saw it 2 weeks ago for those kids, that's probably nothing compared to the way that the men, they sleep on cement slabs with a straw mat. You can imagine the kinds of problems that arise when you have 600 men living in one barracks with literally nothing to do. The mine was purchased in 1964 by two American companies, the Newmont Mining Company and American Metal Climax. It was purchased for $3 million, and now, and this was, my statistics are about 5 years old, it was netting $17 million a year for their $3 million investment. It is a very, very profitable investment for these two American companies. A black is not allowed to be over a white person in any kind of supervisory work. Whites make 10 times the salary that our black brothers do in the Tsumi mine. 80% of Namibians eke out a living and receive an annual income that is below the poverty line set by the South African government for what they conclude to be a salary adequate to feed, house, and clothe a family of four. 80% of the people live below that poverty line. Worldwide, when the United States makes an investment in another country, we get back on our investment 10.8%. In Namibia, we get back almost 20%, about 19 some percent, which is almost double what we would get back on an investment. And part of that is just because of the very, very cheap labor. There is very heavy investment by United States company, by United States corporations, basically the Chase Manhattan Bank and First Citibank of New York, where your Visa card comes from. Ford and Chrysler have a lot of plants and investments in Namibia. Del Monte and Purina, Del Monte for fish, for sardines, and Purina buy sardines. Actually, many commentators say they exploit them for cat food, because the United Nations asks that no country take natural resources out of Namibia until it gains its independence. Because our Lutheran bishops are saying, if you countries in the West continue to take if we export or allow you to take these resources out of our country, when we are free, we will have absolutely no way to sustain ourselves. So the United Nations has asked that we not do this. We are fishing to extinction many species of fish off Walvis Bay, which is the only deep port that the whole country of Namibia has. So Del Monte, Purina, Ford, Chrysler, just many, many American countries, as well as many British companies and Dutch companies, have great investments in Namibia. Also, our oil companies, namely Gulf and Texaco, control 44% of the petroleum that comes out of that country. The American oil companies, especially Gulf, also has oil wells north of Ovamboland into Angola. And if you will remember, in 1976, South Africa invaded Angola. The CIA was in on this invasion. There's proof of that. I can't tell you how or to what extent, but two of the pamphlets that came out from Lutheran World Federation said there was no doubt about this. Angola has Cuban troops in Angola who were invited there by the Angolan government to help put down the invasion that took place over 2 years by South Africa. The troops are Marxist. They are still there protecting the rights of the Angola government. But going back to the apartheid system, just a few more things before I get onto this other. The Terrorism Act is a part of the apartheid system because it means that if you speak out against the government of South Africa, you can be banned. Many of our Lutheran leaders, including Manos Buthelezi in South Africa, has been banned. That means you are not allowed to gather with more than two people. You're not allowed to speak out. You're not allowed to criticize the government. These books are banned in South Africa and Namibia. James Michener's The Covenant. Have any of you read it? Talk to Jessie. She's in love with this book. Alan Paton's Cry the Beloved Country is banned. Steve Biko, I Write What I Like. Our friend Joe Barnt was at Steve Biko's funeral. David Mezenbrink, who's been here on teaching staff, knew Steve Biko. Was he at Steve Biko's funeral, too?
I don't think so. He helped get the manuscript
right.
out.
Dave Mezenbrink helped get this information out. Steve Biko was tortured as a political prisoner in prison and died. All of these books are banned. That means that the South African government doesn't like what they have to say, and they are in some way frightened. Marriage laws. You're not allowed to marry outside of your Bantustan. All of these apartheid laws go completely against the Declaration of Human Rights that the United Nations has set forth. Just as a something to do for myself a couple years ago. I took the Declaration of Human Rights with all its articles. I read them, and then I wrote underneath how the South African government has thwarted and been in opposition to every human right that was laid down. We're supposed to be able to marry whomever we please. In South Africa and in Namibia, you are not allowed to marry outside of your Bantustan. So the apartheid system, or if you do, you can't live with your wife. If you're of the Herero tribe and you marry an Ovambo, you're not allowed to live together. So apartheid not only separates black from whites, it also separates blacks from blacks. And they do this because they don't want people getting together, joining forces, and somehow subverting the government. Education, it's supposed to be free for people. It is free for whites in Namibia. For blacks, they must pay. It is mandatory for whites. Blacks can only go if they can afford to. The average amount of money spent on education for each white child in Namibia is $700 a year. For each black, it is $70 a year. A year ago in New York, I met with my friend Pat Hayden and a woman from Namibia who was with the Namibian Council of Churches. She was in charge of the education program. She was over here to try to get scholarship help for Namibians who wanted to come over to the United States and do graduate work. There are only 9 Namibian young people who are prepared to come and do graduate work.
But they're not allowed to come.
If they were, yes, they probably could be allowed, especially now that the United States is much more friendly with South Africa. But the fact that only 9 have reached the point in the educational system in Namibia, and that's just not Lutherans, that's 9 people total in Namibia.
What do you mean graduate? Beyond high school? Or
beyond college. There are 18 who are qualified to go to college at this point. That was a year ago. And 9 who can come for higher education, for graduate work. That just, I find that very hard to believe. Because in Zimbabwe, for instance, the leaders are now Christians, and many of them Lutheran and Methodists, who have come up through our missionary schools. But the educational system, there aren't that many Lutheran schools in Namibia or mission schools. Healthcare. The highest doctor-patient ratio of any place in the world you find in Namibia among whites. 1 to 400... And I forgot to put it down. I think it's 1 to every 445 people. A doctor for every 445 people. For blacks, it is 1 doctor for every 44,000 people. Half of the children in Namibia die before they reach the age of 5, and 55,000 people die each year from tuberculosis. That's just a few of the health problems in Namibia. Steve, when you get your doctor's degree, why don't you go over and help, okay? Torture. You're not supposed to do that. As an example to the rest of Namibians, South Africans, troops have been putting political prisoners, SWAPO agents, and we'll talk about SWAPO in a minute, in steel cages, taking electric shock to the groin of the men, groins of the men who stand in these electric cages out in the heat. I just read an article in the Lutheran, which is also upstairs. They were talking in January, it was 100 degrees, and under the metal roofs where the service took place that they were discussing in this article, it must have been 120. But I can just imagine the heat, the lack of water, the cages are such that the people can't even sit down, they must stand, and they're kept in there for days at a time. Torture is, there are many, many instances that have come before Amnesty International of torture, and of also of our Lutheran pastors, Lutheran nurses. One Lutheran nurse who was suspected of giving $15 to a member of SWAPO was tortured, and her testimony came before Lutheran World Ministries and eventually before the United Nations. SWAPO is a multiracial group, which is the National Liberation Group of Namibia. It stands for Southwest African People's Organization. SWAPO is said to be communist, and that's the big thing that you hear. Our bishop of the Ovambo-Kavambo Lutheran Church, can you all say Ovambo-Kavambo? Okay, it's ELOC, Evangelical Lutheran Ovambo-Kovambo Church, ELOC, E-L-O-C. Bishop Cleopas Domeni is our Lutheran bishop in Namibia, and as I are in Ovamboland, the Bantustan in the northern part of Namibia. He says, yeah, we hear that all the time. I want to tell you that most of SWAPO are Lutheran. I do not consider them communists. I commune them, I baptize them, I marry them, I bury them. The SWAPO, the head of SWAPO himself, before a congressional committee and before the United Nations, said, yes, we went to Dar es Salaam and we knocked on the doors of all the Western embassies, asking them for help to fight against the South African oppressors. We were met with nothing but contempt and hostility. So yes, then we went to Eastern Bloc nations and other African nations. Yes, we do receive help from Eastern Bloc nations. This does not mean that we are necessarily communists. They do have Marxist leanings. But Ed May at Lutheran World Community, or head of the World Community Desk of Lutheran World Ministries, says, what is worse, to live under a Marxist, or getting arms from Marxist sources, or to live under the oppression of the apartheid system of the South African government? Paul.
Are those arms coming through Angola then? Do they admit
that? Yes, they're getting some arms through Angola.
Okay.
But as far as the head of SWAPO said, if you think there is a communist hiding behind every bush and rock in Namibia, you're wrong. He said, I don't know one black communist. Now, you know, somewhere is the truth, and I suppose it's somewhere in the middle. I would like to think that our Lutheran brothers and sisters would continue to remain nonviolent in Namibia. But when you read one of these articles by Bishop Cleopas Domeni, it's 4 pages. If you're interested, he was for a mission celebration one Sunday. Over 1,000 people were gathered to worship, and in came the South African troops, leveling their guns, pushing with bayonets, kicking, dragging off people that were suspected to be SWAPO agents, always disrupting church services, checking everybody. Martial law is now in effect in Namibia, which limits 80% of the people's movement is limited. The article in the Lutheran talks about our two presidents from our churches, the LCA and the ALC, Dr. Preuss and Dr. Crumley, going over to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Lutheran Church in Ovamboland, of the Ovambo-Kovambo Lutheran Church. And it was a very exciting thing. The editorial in the Lutheran said, we wonder, though, how they so easily got visas when it has been impossible to get a visa to go into Namibia. In fact, our representatives from Lutheran World Federation from Geneva, Switzerland, were denied admission to the country, as well as people from Finland who had helped start the church in the beginning.
Mary, look, you...
I've jumped around.
No, you gave the impression that they were calling for violent revolution and accepting guns. You also said, we hope they continue to be nonviolent. What is the... I mean, obviously there are varieties within SWAPO. What is the official stand? Violent revolution or continued nonviolent resistance?
They're not committed to continued nonviolent resistance, as far as I can tell. They are fighting guerrilla-type warfare. Many of them have fled the country. A great percentage of the young people, and many have left, literally thousands and thousands of young people have left because the South African government is trying to conscript them into the army to fight against SWAPO. And they refuse to do that.
They go
to Zambia, to Angola. Many the missionaries and pastors from Namibia, black pastors, are going to work among the refugee camps. Kasinga in Angola is one of the largest refugee camps, and in 1978, I think it was, South African troops came and slaughtered 1,000 refugees, most of them women and children, but also some men. There are pictures in some of the literature I have of just huge common graves where all the Namibians were dumped.
it continues, you know, I just didn't finish my sentence because I got sidetracked. I would hope that they would continue through negotiation and to react nonviolently, but absolutely nothing is happening that brings many signs of hope. A few of the petty apartheid rules have been lifted. Travel is easier for blacks now in Namibia. Blacks are now allowed to own land, which was kind of a safe thing to say because nobody can afford to buy a piece of land. They tried after the Turnhalle talks to give blacks representation on the government, but the blacks that were put up for election were all puppets of the South African government. And I saw in Time magazine that the white leader of the Democratic Turnhalle Alliance, which is one of the parties, Muggy, I think his name was, has simply resigned as head of the party. He just could see no sense in the way the government was being run. And I don't know whether that's good or bad for the blacks because there was no editorial comment. The blacks say, once you had the Bible and we had our land, but since the white man came to our country, now they have our land and we have the Bible. And that's a very sad commentary on what many times we do when we bring our missionaries in. Bishop Dumaney recently made a statement, and he said it again to Dr. Preuss and Dr. Crumley. I hold Prime Minister Botha of South Africa and President Reagan personally responsible for the continued bloodshed in Namibia. And they give these reasons. First of all, instead of the United States, let me jump back to a couple more of these things on the blue sheet. In 1978, five contact nations in the United Nations, United States, Canada, Britain, France, and Germany, band together and put forth a resolution, Resolution 435, which was adopted by the United Nations, calling for the end to hostilities, the right to free election and self-government, get the South African troops out of Namibia, and free the political prisoners. Instead of, again, putting any economic sanctions, the United States over the past year, especially since the election of President Reagan, has become more and more friendly with South Africa. And we have been doing things, even though we're not allowed to supply military things, we have been giving them surveillance planes, which can be easily converted to military planes. We just recently allowed the sale of electric batons, which they use not to prod cattle, but against our black brothers and sisters. They are sending military advisors and attachés to South Africa. And they have added a real stumbling block in the negotiations, which a year ago really seemed to be coming to a head. It seemed that South Africa was going to allow for free elections and were going to allow the United Nations to come in and supervise, and they were going to withdraw their troops. Since that time, the United States has put the condition that before there can be a settlement, before South African troops should withdraw, the Cuban troops should withdraw from Angola. Bishop Dumaney, or at least one in the editorial in the Lutheran, says, though the South African self-righteously proclaims it is fighting godless communism, in fact, its godless practices are dangerously close to terrorizing people into thinking that communism may be their only choice for freedom. I also put at the bottom of your sheet, people who need your letters. If you feel that, before I open it up for discussion, that you need to write a letter of support to people like Dr. Abasai and Selma, and I don't know how you pronounce their last name, Shejavli. This man went to Wartburg Seminary for 7 years. They've had Namibian pastors studying in Dubuque at the seminary. He was just elected the new General Secretary of the Namibian Council of Churches. It is a very dangerous position. Any church leader or prominent black businessman in Namibia has been put on a hit list. There were consistent murders, and when this hit list finally got in the hands of the Windhoek newspaper, and newspapers are so powerful, as you know, the newspaper published the list of the Lutheran leaders, the Anglican leaders, and the businessmen that were up for assassination. And from that time on, the assassination ceased, because even the whites in Namibia couldn't believe that this was going on, a very consistent way to eliminate all of these people. But this pastor, this Lutheran pastor, who is now head of the Namibian Council of Churches, according to our friends at Wartburg, say that this is a very dangerous position to have. And Cleopas Demeny, the bishop of Elok, is a very courageous man. The church and SWAPO, which is mostly Lutherans, is what is the hope, if you can call it that hope at all, or at least they're speaking out strongly in opposition to the South African government, not considering the fact that their life is in danger. If you want to protest the United States stand as far as its insistence that Angolan troops get out of there, or that the Cuban troops get out of Angola, Bishop Demeny said, I don't know what that has to do with our country. They're above us, they're not even in Namibia. I don't understand why that is so important. We think that the United States is in it for its own self-interest, or is looking out for its own self-interest, and not for the interests of the Namibian people. If you feel that way, you can write to your senator, your congressperson, and certainly to President Reagan. Okay, what kind of comments or questions do you have? Things you'd like to say? Paul.
Does the Netherlands, what's their relationship with Namibian others? See how those are, seem to be their people that are the oppressors down there.
Well, some of the Dutch Anglicans and some of the Dutch Reformed churches are speaking out very strongly. They were the ones that refused to buy gasoline, ask all their people not to buy petroleum from countries who had investments in South Africa. But on the whole, the Afrikaners, the Dutch, consider themselves to be very strong Christian people. I mean, they don't worship with blacks, and the apartheid system is in full swing, but they really consider their goal in life to be God-given, and that is that blacks are inferior to whites, and that they must continue to rule over, to manage. See, South Africa is so afraid that if they continue to go through Namibia, especially Ovamboland, and wage war against Angola, because they see Angola as the last vestige or the last kind of stance against communism. They were really concerned when Zimbabwe became Zimbabwe instead of Rhodesia, and blacks now rule it, because they just can't believe that blacks can rule a country. And so now they're seeing that, well, maybe this is true. And it's both a sign that maybe they'll let loose a little, and then on the other hand, they just can see all of the countries being taken over by communism and want to make sure that that doesn't happen. So they want a buffer between themselves and godless communism, which is flourishing in Angola. So they want to make sure that Namibia is still there as a buffer zone, and that it doesn't become communist. John.
Let's assume some censorship. Let's assume they at least know how much mail they get. Do the leaders say that it's helpful that the government knows how many people here have an interest and are writing to say, we remember you in our prayers or something? In other words, what would you say, and what effect does it have that they get a lot of mail?
Cleopas Demeny's one comment about the mail was that he's seen many, many letters of support from people, Lutherans throughout the world, and especially in the United States. But he just can't understand, with all these letters of support, why something more isn't happening as far as our government is concerned. He didn't say anything about the censorship, but it seems to me if they are censored, it's good to know. I mean, even if they are censored, at least the government there knows that all this mail is coming through. But I don't have any information there.
I was just reading the paper about El Salvador, and it's related that the Reagan administration is really trying now to get $60 million more dollars for arms for El Salvador. And the biggest block to that is the Roman Catholic Church, because it's both Reagan and the Secretary of State is you know, have commented on the Roman Catholic Church. And part of that is I think that Roman Catholics have more of a sense than Lutherans do, a sense of worldwide community. That I guess is the most frustrating. Why isn't every Lutheran in the United States feeling these are my brothers and sisters in a very, not only in Christ but also denominationally, which makes us, you know, so close to them, and yet we tend to be Americans first. I think there are signs of hope that more and more Lutherans are becoming concerned. I know that ALC is having a conference this week.
In fact, it's going on the 4th to the 6th. Yeah, I think we should continue to pray for those kinds of things.
I just dream of the time when our government will say, be critical of the Lutherans for getting too nosy about this, and there'd be a situation that I've never heard that yet.
Well, Lutheran World Federation pushes very hard, as does Lutheran World Ministries. I mean, we have, but it's been 20 years of push, 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 and it's just like moving Gibraltar. Who had their hand in it?
You mentioned that the American companies, you know, especially the Purina and the Del Monte, would it help to have a boycott like you did for the Nestle?
There's been talk of that. There have been trying, we've asked, many of the Lutheran bodies have tried to pull out their investments when they're with those companies. The Newmont Mining Company, people that have tried to go to stockholders meetings and talk to that about the Tsumi mine. Some things have been done as far as working conditions have been improved, but Leonard Awala, who was the Lutheran bishop before Domeni, said, on the other hand, that's the only source of income that the people from Ovambalam have, literally, is to go down and work in the mine, and even though they're away from their families 12 months, still, we'd hate to see it go. We're caught in the horns of a dilemma. But we're suffering now. We just think maybe we need to suffer with hope. And right now, they don't see a lot of hope. So maybe if there was more activity in stockholders' meetings and more divestment, that this would be important. The ALC and the LCA have both voted in their conventions to divest funds from in corporations that are active there. Yeah. Anybody else who has more information, or correct me where I'm wrong, anyway, sure.
Does the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa still support the government?
Oh yes, they are the government.
Mm-hmm. They are,
yeah.
Still.
Very.
There have been some voices within the church of criticism within the last 2 or 3 years that's new.
Yep, that's true. In fact, the Reform, like our Lutheran World Federation, they have a national or an international Reformed convention, I forget what it's called. They have condemned the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa and asked them to withdraw because of the apartheid system. And that was very hard for the Reformed Church to in South Africa to hear.
They've even used the words in a state of heresy.
Yes.
I think that's really strong.
Well, and Lutheran World Federation has declared status, John, do you want to explain status confessionis?
That opposition to apartheid is of the status of a confession. Mm. For Lutherans to say that, it's saying that it is one of the marks of what it means to be faithful to Jesus Christ. In other words, it's like doctrinally believing Jesus is Lord, or sacraments, or what have you. It's of the status of a confession to be in opposition to apartheid. But for Lutherans, it's a little different. For the Reformed, I think the Reformed in convention declare that the group there is in a state of heresy. You're in status confessionis when you come as the group that is pleading that to the Lutheran World Federation and ask them to recognize that it is for you a state of confession. It has to come from the people
who are
feeling
impressed.
Strongly.
Yeah.
It doesn't get legislated and sent down in Lutheran.
That's true.
It's the other direction.
Mm.
I think I'd like to have a Vespers in the next couple of weeks where we do what Tom did with letter writing and maybe make it specifically do something. Letters are really important. Just again, writing a letter of support to Bishop Domeni, when I've written to Leonard Awala, the bishop, before, and got back a lovely letter. I mean, he just took time to answer and say how meaningful it is to know that we recognize the situation and that we are with them in our prayers and our thoughts and trying to do what we can to educate people and to influence in some way. If you can write letters to the editor of the Wenatchee World or the Seattle Times or your local paper, if those things get published, that's important to spread the word about the situation in Namibia. In the summertime when I do a session on Namibia, if 50 people are there and I say, how many of you people know about Namibia, maybe 3 will raise their hand. And that really concerns me, because as Dan said, those are our Lutheran brothers and sisters. But even if you're just a humanitarian, it seems to me that we need to be concerned. Letters to radio stations that might get read, or town councils that could write a letter to the representative that represents them from in their state. All of these kinds of things are important. It's just our way of exercising our Christian citizenship.
I don't see how we can say we're Christian or Great Britain or any of these countries involved in this if they allow such things to go on.
Well, nations aren't Christian. People within them are.
That's right. Yet we're considered a Christian nation.
Is there anyone like Dick Clark who's now in either the House or the Senate for whom this is really a strong issue? For a while, when he was head of the South or the Africa Committee, there was constant pressure. He's out, and
I don't know. Does anybody even know who's head of that? I don't know. Anything else? Yeah, Bob.
You said that you were hoping that they would continue in a non-violent way of trying to make advancements. Where is their hope? Condoning violence, but I'm just wondering where the nonviolent emphasis would be, and what are the methods that they can or have or are planning?
I guess I have to say I would never legislate or say what people in that situation would do. I mean, the bishop has a cannon pointed at his house, and all of the roads are mined. You have to be in your house by dusk or you're subject to arrest. I mean, I have no idea. To sit here and say I think they should remain nonviolent is really stupid on my part. So if they choose violence as the worst, as just a bad thing, but maybe better than doing nothing, I don't think we can condemn that.
John? But he's asking, how did they remain nonviolent, which they've done for many years?
I think a lot of that had to do with the gospel of Jesus Christ and preaching of the churches. They're very strong. 70% of Namibia is Christian. Only 60% of the United States is. Why we send missionaries there, I don't know. But I think part of that was the influence of the church and the very strong Christian understanding. But it's, they have waited and waited and waited, and absolutely nothing has happened, and they have been tortured and killed, and I don't know where the hope would be to remain nonviolent. That's just my hope. I don't know that they would have a hope for freedom if the God of history is waiting to work out a plan in time. Maybe that's, I don't know.
The film strip that Lutheran Council did, the one person interviewed said, many people outside of our country and in our country tell us to do what you did, and that is take up arms like you did to get your freedom, and we understand that, but so far we are committed to be followers of Jesus and committed to nonviolence. And the
the typical nonviolent actions that you think of in the world, they are not free to do. The Bantustans that separate them and the restrictions and all that. They did choose the name Namibia. They have appealed to the United Nations. They have done all the things legally. There have been boycotts of the elections, so they have some way to spread the word and say no to that. But I don't, I guess it's a hope.
Well,
their prayers, and because I don't think there's, other than SWAPO, I don't think they've had the possibility of strategizing for nonviolent resistance.
The two ways they had of spreading the word, or the way that they had mainly, was through the printing press that the Lutheran Church runs in Ovamboland. And in 1973 and in 1980, it was bombed. And both times, the Lutheran World Federation and people throughout the world have contributed funds, so it's been rebuilt again. That's one hopeful sign. I think the Namibians, or the South African government, sees people coming to the help when South African troops do bomb the printing presses. Also, SWAPO was recognized by the United Nations several years ago as the official representative of the Namibian people. And that certainly was a hopeful sign. And last year, there was great hope that there would be free elections and that South Africa would get out. And then we threw in this monkey wrench again about the troop withdrawal from Angola. So, okay, thank you for, oh, excuse me, Paul.
What's been the Christian impact in Angola, you know? If there's a Christian revolutionary feeling sprouting there, maybe that would flow over into Namibia. I don't know.
I think I read somewhere that Namibian missionaries are in Angola, which is kind of interesting.
You said South Africa was hoping that Angola would not go communist. What is the government of Angola now? I'm ignorant.
I think it's Marxist.
So it already has gone. So that's, yeah. South Africa is worried about Namibia,
right,
as the last,
yes,
buffer.
I
misunderstood.
Yeah, I probably didn't say that very clearly.
Mm. Well, right after the Vietnam War, I think Henry Kissinger, right when that whole thing came up, asked through the president to side with the South Africans against the communists in Angola and to put American advisors in the
advisors
to fight against Angola. And that, of course, was voted down because, you know, people like Dick Clark wouldn't say that kind of thing. But I think it's kind of ironic that I sit here holding, talk about the problems of Namibia, yet 10 years ago, our government was asking Congress to actually go in and fight on the side of the South Africans.
Well, keep them in your prayers, and get your pen and pencil out, if you feel like writing something. And just spread the word. I think that's very important. We're very ignorant about a lot of things, and you wonder how it's been going on for so long. I didn't hear about it till 1972, and I couldn't believe that I wasn't aware that this had all been going on to people. So thank you very much for your attention.